massive apologies about the delay getting started and the menu not being opened on time. I'm sorry about that. My name's Nick. I'm one of the organisers for the Movement for Cultural Democracy. This is the first of four sessions we're going to have over the next 2 days for the Movement for Cultural Democracy that have helped organise this session. So the first one, as you know, is on regenerating regeneration. We're going to start in just a second. I just wanted to encourage you, if you can, to make it to all four sessions. There'll be three sessions on different themes, one further one this afternoon, and two more tomorrow. The fourth session, in a sense, brings it all together. All the different strands will be reporting back, plus other groups that have been working as part of the movement will be reporting on what they're doing, and we'll be talking about how we can take the whole project forward. So if you can make that fourth session as well, it'll be great to see you there. Without further ado, I'll pass over to Stephen, who'll tell you how this session is going to work. Thanks a lot.
Hi. Thanks for coming. So basically, today, what we're going to do is we've got Liam is going to talk a little bit about Liverpool regeneration, in particular, I guess, around this area here. You've probably all seen the areas at different stages of regen, but I won't talk anymore about that. Liam will speak, then we'll have some questions for Liam, and I'd like to show a relatively short film called Off the Devil's Party. Sorry, in My Beginning is My End, and then we'll just talk, I think. I would like to talk for as long as possible, and talk not just to us, but with each other, about your own thoughts around regeneration, and how it can be possibly done in a positive way. Because this regeneration, for me, has got a bad name, and I think that whilst that name is off, fairly justified in many cases. What we need to think about are positive ways to think about how can we do this to benefit everyone, not just the rich elite. But without any further ado, I'll pass over to the
thanks. Hi everybody. Really great turnout actually for 9 a.m. on a Sunday morning. So thanks for waiting outside in the cold and coming in. Thanks for the introduction as well. As I say, my name is Liam and I'm the chair of the Baltic Triangle Area Community Chess Company, or for sure we just call it the Area Company. And that is a group of nominated directors who run a sort of a stakeholders engagement group. And the stakeholders are businesses, they are the visitors to the area, they are the tenants, they are the companies, and the property developers, and everybody who has an influence over the past 10 years or so in this area. Now, the Baltic Triangle is sort of Liverpool's living example of place-based regeneration. And a lot of what has happened here over the past 10 years has not happened by mistake, and has not happened in a sort of ad hoc way, as much of an ad hoc way as people might think. It's been a very dedicated group of people, including, you know, the pioneering property developers that came out here, as well as the pioneering businesses and artists who made their way here in this part of the city, largely because the rents were cheap, which is a common theme that goes through all those sorts of decision making, and also the availability of space and just the excitement of the sort of the frontier element to a new part of the city. Extraordinarily lucky that Liverpool is a city that has quite a lot of real estate that's still available very close to its city centre. It's not just this end in the south end of the city that had this many spaces and land available for regeneration and growth, but also again in the north of the city. And over in that way, the City Council have designated that area and given it a spatial regeneration framework and, you know, and a brand and an identity and all that sort of stuff so that they can go away and talk about it. But that's slightly separate to the idea that there were already people in those areas doing things. So I'll give you a brief overview of the last 10 years here in the Baltic Triangle. So 10 years-ish ago, the Baltic Triangle had been earmarked to be the red light district of Liverpool. there was the potential for a government policy that cities would be allowed to designate an area to control that element of city life and to put it into, you know, one particular part of the city, and I suppose sort of influence it negatively or positively, depending on how you want to view it. That legislation never actually made it out, but it does tell you that the way that this area was viewed. And then not very much further on from that in terms of time, some pioneers came down here, you know, namely A Foundation and Jane Casey and other people who just decided, you know, we're just going to go out in this direction. And sort of at the same time, the CUC was opened as something else, which is the big brick building, which you can see when you go out to the street to the left. You know, and once a small cluster of activity started to happen, you know, things started really to move from there. The area was called the Baltic Triangle because of its history, and it's designated that on a map. And you know, it's quite a catchy name. We gave it a location title and a brand and an identity. We started to talk about it in a particular way, and we started to establish a sort of set of values and a vision for the area. And this is what I mean by it didn't happen by mistake. You know, it was very much that this group of people got together, and you know, they set out a store for what they wanted to see the area become, and also the opportunities that this area had. So really critically, as part of the regeneration of this area, an organisation that you're in right now, Baltic Creative, is a community interest company as well. And they were gifted these buildings, these sheds, as you know, post-crash, as part of a plan for economic regen. They were gifted the buildings and initially going to be given a couple of million, and obviously that got cut in half. And actually, you know, hats off to the mayor of Liverpool, who went out and rescued all of the money and sort of brought it back so that it could happen. And you know, a real sort of critical piece of council intervention that gave the sector an asset, or gave the sector a couple of assets. And since then, this organisation has been able to rent out space and encourage creatives, particularly the creative digital sector, to sort of take place here. And you know, this has happened at the same time as the economy has changed and will change again. And the big change has been the sort of the increase in the amount of SMEs and micro SMEs that are happening, the amount of people who are freelancing, and the amount of people who are, you know, trying to turn their hobbies into and their passions into their own economy. And they take small spaces and they want to work collaboratively. And these two things happening side by side means that Baltic Creative actually drives a massive surplus, which is great because it's owned by the sector. It's a community interest company that value is locked within this model. And there is a, you know, a nominated board of directors who take no remuneration from the company. And that creates this pot that they've then gone on to be able to, you know, buy other assets. And from there, we've been able to open up Canes and encourage more people to move in there and work with landlords and developers to sort of make it happen. But it hasn't been without the challenge, and I wrote an open letter quite recently called Liverpool's Culture is for Sale, which talks about how over the past 10 years we've achieved all of these things. Now we have a whole new set of challenges that we now face in terms of we've created all this value, and although we own a small part of it, actually that value is now being cashed in by other people, and we haven't yet found a way to make sure that everybody shares in that value. So that's the long story short, and I think we'll do 5 minutes of questions if anybody has any. Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you.
So if anyone,
You were just talking there about getting access to value, because mm-hmm. this actually, what this raises is the whole issue of the notion of the regional and local development bank, so that you actually create an institution where, because it's not possible now for you to decide to invest in your local community. There isn't an institution that will direct investment into your local community. If you put your money into any financial institution, you lose control of it. You might obviously get the profit that will come to you from the activities, but you can't decide where to send it. And it seems to me that is utterly crucial that we have institutions that can be directed.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that, so two things on that. First of all, one of the things that we have thought about doing for the area company, because it's just a, you know, the governance of the area company isn't the greatest, and actually, in a way to improve it, might be that we can offer community shares for people to invest their money into the area. That would allow us to go around purchasing the assets that remain in the area, and actually that money, you would get a return on your investment. So our initial plan is that, in terms of like capital economics, is if you invest £5, £500, £5,000, we'll give you a return in 5 years, because we will be raising the value of that. But that still doesn't resolve the problem. And the problem is that we value things in a very capital-centric way. And actually, you know, if you remove all of the people from this building, it's valueless. Mm-hmm. And it's the activity. We have to find a way of valuing the activity. And also, in the model that we have, being able to do things like lend against it. And, you know, I don't have the answers to those questions, but I definitely know...
Well, I think that's where the model of the local... Sorry.
Get some other questions.
Yeah,
sure.
We can come back to that.
The regeneration seems to be going well. How do you protect it against gentrification, like what's happening in London? And are the developers already trying to... Because now it's started, they see like a new place to go in. They've done that with like Manchester and Birmingham. So have they done that here, and or are they trying to do it here? How do you stop that?
So we definitively had nobody living here. So at least we are able to avoid that horrific part of gentrification, where communities who have lived in an area for a while are then forced to move out. So we have avoided that almost entirely in the Baltic Triangle. But in the other part of gentrification, which is, you know, the pioneers and the early adopters that come here and open venues and open cafes and start their businesses here, I think the only way... Mark Twain said, buy land, because they're not making any more of it. And in the model that we have right now, it's probably still very true. And I don't see any other way of having power unless you are able to either influence land or own it yourself. Really interesting thing that's come away from that, from the objection that we put into one of the planning applications, is that we actually won an argument in the town hall about a proposed development that came here, and it created quite a lot of fuss. It was in the local press quite a lot. I actually also didn't expect to win, which was really interesting. But ever since then, you know, the developer came to us and we worked with them to make sure that we could set out our vision, and that they shared in some of the things that we wanted to see. The retention of the public art that would be lost, as an example. The making sure that the train station could be reopened, etc. And ever since then, all the other developers also have started to, you know, send emails and reach out and want to have conversations with us, because we ran a really successful campaign, and they all have upcoming planning permission. So at the very least, we are now able to go and sit at the table with them and have those conversations. So without the owning of land, we're at least able to influence its value, and it's, you know, they don't want to spend another £500,000 on another round of planning applications, so, you know, they have no other choice really, I suppose, in a crude sense.
Time for one quick question.
So, as a group in our transcend in the area, how do you see the future of the area in the next 10 years?
I mean, how do we see the future in the next 10 years? Full stop. I think it's a really difficult question to answer. I spend most of my professional life trying to convince, Patrick's laughing here because he's asked me to go and speak to the council about this, convince the people in decision-making positions that actually in the next 30 years life will be unrecognisable. As a good example, you know, our city council has talked a number of times about trying to encourage Amazon to open a warehouse here because it will bring a lot of jobs. But they are exactly the kind of jobs that will be almost immediately lost in the next decade, because of automation and AI. And we can either look at that in fear, or we can embrace that and say, and find a way to be ready for the change. And actually, areas like this are going to be key to that. Because what we have here is an experience economy, and the one thing that we know that will persist is the human desire to be a part of experiences. You know, just down the road, we have Liverpool One, a massive, massive retail and leisure development. And it's been fantastic for the city, you have to say that. But, you know, 50,000 job losses so far this year in retail, and that's just going to continue to snowball. And you eventually, cities like Liverpool are going to have to find answers to that challenge. And actually, areas like this are already providing them. So I don't know the answer to that question, but I know that we are further ahead in trying to find them.
Okay, thank you. Thanks, Liam. So we can come back to, I think, a lot of these things, and hopefully it will help set the context for the discussion to follow. What I'd like to... We're a bit late, and I want to have as much room as possible for discussion, so I want to put it to the room whether anyone wants to hear my take on things, or you just want to talk about it and the take and things might come out that way. I was hoping to show a film called, and it was the wrong film, but I have realised that. I'd like to show you something about, I guess, around the idea around the Creative Commons. And I think that we've touched on some of these things in terms of perhaps mutual ownership, etc. But for me, regeneration needs to come right from the grassroots, and that means that's about who's involved in planning, who decides, and what's consultation about, who consults, and who are consulted, and who are not consulted. And I think that these are questions, and perhaps this delves down way below the creative sector as well, and to people who don't have the privileges that we do operate within the creative sector as well. So shall I show the film then, is that alright?
Yeah.
Hopefully it'll work. I haven't tested it well here, yeah. But let's I think what interests me is his ideas around how can the arts and culture how can arts and culture encourage work with people in communities to help but not take over, not lead? How can it help people become involved in the planning process? How can it facilitate and mediate potentially so that people can make their own way in life, and you know, there are interesting ideas around the use of money being that might be earmarked for the creative sector to be given to local communities to build windmills which feed into electric. Into the electricity grid, and that all the money that comes from that can be given to a community who set themselves up as a community benefit society or cooperative, and can actually use that money to fund their own actions and activities in the community, whatever that might be, and decide communally together. So I'm interested in the idea of really looking at like participatory democracy. On its very, very local level.
I was just going to say what you're talking about is exactly why I'm here.
Right.
And because I've been working within a community group in my local town. We're not a city. We're a very small borough in Borough of Broxbourne. I don't know if anyone knows it. Very small place that's like overwhelmed by people at the moment because people are moving out of London to live, and there's a lot of buildings going up and most of it is housing. And what our problem is not that we have empty buildings, but we have like I say metaphorically, like empty communities who don't have the creative initiative or any creative resources to, as I say, like think outside the box in terms of how communities and societies should be living. So, yeah, like that's exactly why I'm interested in what the World Transformed is doing, and then also like what you're talking about regeneration and like how that can happen more locally, and also helping those who think they're not creative, whereas I think everyone is. And I think it's a really interesting discussion to have about.
So we've got a really good example here, in particularly in Baltic Creative, about how value is different within different sectors. And I think quite crudely, art in its purest form, i.e. fine art, sculpture, etc., etc., it creates less value than digital creative. You know, three people making one app creates more value in terms of cash than 20, 30 artists. So what Baltic Creative have done is they've opened a space called Northern Lights, which is where Hinterland is part of, and they've accepted that they're going to make less money because they can, because Baltic Creative is a community interest company and it has those values as its guiding force. And actually in terms of capital value that's created from the app developers and the photographers and the videographers and the agencies, you know, essentially, you know, they create arbitrary figures, they create a 30% surplus, and over there they only create 20% surplus, then they're fine with that disparity. As long as the economics stack up, they're using one to subsidize the existence of the other, because without each other, we have no ecosystem, then we have a vacuous community. Actually, the true value of the Baltic Triangle is the fact that it's so plural, and there are so many different people doing so many different things, and we all need one another, and we're just having to find a different way of making that stack up economically.
Okay, cool. Well, I'm sure we'll come back to that. Okay. Couldn't someone get that? Is there a light there in the pot? Hopefully this works. If it doesn't, I'm going to go home. It's not. What is it? Is it? Talk instead, then, without any pictures.
Now, without contraries is no progression. Attraction and repulsion, reason and energy, love and hate are necessary to human existence. From these contraries spring what the religious call good and evil. Good is the passive that obeys evil. Evil is the act of springing from energy. Good is heaven, evil is hell. The reason Milton wrote in fetters, says William Blake, when he wrote of angels and God, and at liberty, when of devils and hell, is because he was a true poet and of the devil's party without knowing it.
He was very anti-government or anti-authority.
Contradiction is what makes us human. It creates dialectical tension. If it is good to passively obey heavenly reason and evil to energetically disobey it, to exist in hell, then is it not better to be of the devil's party? If, as the psychoanalyst D.W. Winnicott argues, living creatively is a healthy state, whilst compliance is a sick basis for life, does this mean we, as artists, are of the devil's party?
Pew, pew, bottom of the crew, devil corrupt.
If the art world is now so utterly instrumentalised and normalised in the service of technocratic neoliberal governance and corporate exploitation, does it fetter us to reason, to rationalism? Is this what creativity increasingly is becoming today? Effectively, creativity is non-creativity, uncreative. Uncreative creativity is about obedience, false consent, compliance, and conformity. This, psychoanalysts illustrate, deprives individuals of their freedom to achieve self-realization and relative autonomy. It kills creativity. It disempowers and alienates us. Art, particularly in its recent creative industries incarnation or reincarnation, has entered into a Faustian pact with neoliberalism, gaining power and influence, but only by becoming entirely incorporated into market economics, entrepreneurialism, commodification, consumerism. The term creative industries represents the fusion of neoliberalism with arts and cultural policy, and as such cannot but reproduce and endorse the exploitation and inequities inherent in neoliberalism. In other words, as a neoliberal entity, the creative industries are not only creative, they are also destructive.
I see an innumerable company of the heavenly host crying, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty."
Neoliberalism has not only become hegemonic, it is also a hegemonic form of discourse that has altered how we think and act about everything everywhere. It is the new common sense, taken for granted beyond question, as Harvey suggests. It is therefore essential that arts and cultural policy and the institutions reconsider what they accept as common sense, what they take for granted, what goes unquestioned. For example, what appears to be freedom is in fact anti-democratic, and what appears to be promoting equality instead restores and further entrenches class power. This neoliberal hegemony has extended its grip to the margins, to the excluded, the oppressed, but only with the aim of further shackling them with, to borrow from Blake's London, mind-forged manacles, raw from a barbed consumerism that disguises the city's lust for wealth and for robbery. It has smothered the arts and culture under a fog of new public management speak, art speak, numbers, money, property, privatisation. It drives arts institutions and artists to pioneer new gentrification processes and to support culture-led creative city regeneration initiatives. The arts bathe in the pool of art washing. Art washing is a gloss that can increase an area's desirability and its property values, as well as reinforcing property developers' social licences to operate, and offering positive PR and enhanced consumer trust for developers and local councils. Yet also functions in a smaller scale within communities. What I term community art washing does not seek to increase the value of physical assets such as property and land, nor does it feed from cultural capital. Instead, socially engaged art and creative placemaking become vehicles for the often vacuous process of community consultation by art. Community art washing aims to build or grow social capital within deficient communities, using participation in the arts as a facade for the simultaneous harvesting of local people's existing social capital. Social capital is used to create memorials to disadvantaged communities displaced by gentrification, and is a way of showing how local people were consulted and perhaps even consented to their displacement by property developers and local councillors, who invested in soon-to-be-displaced communities by bringing in an artist or an arts organisation as creative consultants. I argue social capital theory underpins the quiet rise of community art washing. That socially engaged artists employed as its agents should be thought of as social capital artists. Social capital artists gather then sanitise the one thing capitalism cannot commodify, at least until now, the intangible bonds and ties that keep struggling and long-abandoned local people together. Social capital artists gain people's trust only to exploit it in neatly packaged PR-friendly bundles, magically turning the valueless into monetary value via its recycling of an intangible asset.
Here is the clock, the Trumpton clock.
Does it have to be this way? Do we need to be wedded to the global yoke of neoliberalism in all its chimeric forms? Clearly, as uncreative at a marriage vows at the altar of the heavenly creative industries. To do so is to obey the god of capital, of money. To do so is to build fortunes on the false premise of building communities, to be part of the neoliberal project of building mirror glass temples to Mammon anywhere and everywhere. Art can surely be more than this. Art is creative when it's playful and disobedient, when it dissents and refuses to comply or be complicit in tyrannical oppression. My practice and research take D.W. Winnicott's ideas of playing reality, of the third place space, of potential space, and Eric Fromm's work on freedom and disobedience as starting points. I believe it is possible to create safe spaces in which shared senses of not knowing and discovery can develop, and in which radical ideas can be explored. This can be achieved by reintroducing notions of playing, living creatively, aesthetic experience, as cultural experience, potential space, non-compliance, disobedience, self-realisation, and freedom. Art and creativity are part of everyday life. We can explore what it might mean to live together, to be together, The arts are essentially humanistic and social, and this is the moment to think of the arts as such, rather than instrumentalize them in the name of conformity or financial gain, or to reduce them to numbers and evidence-based functions in the positivist conceits of measurability and accountability. And so, I've entered into a marriage of heaven and hell. On the one hand, working with developers, planners, state agencies. On the other, working with grassroots groups, artists, feral educators. The marriage of capitalism and the commons. The marriage of institutions and the anti-institutional. The marriage of regulation and freedom. The marriage of private property and mutual ownership. The marriage of self-interest and collective self-organising. No privileging of pop-ups or hipsterism, scots or bohemianism, staid business models or Molotov cocktails. There is space for all of these elements. There is no space for any one of these elements alone. They all must be part of a commons. Can we regenerate regeneration? Because regeneration has become a dirty word. And yet it is also a positive word, a spiritual word. Can we improve and build in ways that benefit everyone? Can we regenerate and rebuild without displacing working class communities, without resorting to social and ethnic cleansing? Accumulation by dispossession, Harvey says, is neoliberalism's dominant economic paradigm, yet it need not be. It is possible for the arts and culture to operate according to the principles of cultural democracy, of equity and difference. Arts, culture and creativity can release itself from the chains of power, capital and property. But in attempting this marriage, this reconciliation of land grabbing and shared communal ownership, it is never easy. Nevertheless, it must be attempted. My research has shown arts and culture can be a positive means to achieve some degree of autonomous community decision making, and in some instances, ownership. For example, Encampus Arts helped the town of Totnes to plan and implement a new development that resulted from genuine community engagement, or the Stove Network in Dumfries, while successfully buying back the high street, bringing it to life by leading the community in the development of a community benefit society, which offers shared ownership and shared decision making. Or Artifacting, a global collective of socio-cultural artists, architects and designers, who have, by operating as a pseudo NGO in villages in India, Mexico and elsewhere, channeled international arts funding to deliver community infrastructure improvements with sufficient and artistic veneer to keep the funders happy, whilst offering local people answers to their own productive and economic needs in ways which are shared and owned by everyone in the communities. These are but three examples. And I'm currently working with a new Creative Commons business model which develops and relies on mutually beneficial community alliances to create community benefit societies or large ownership community interest companies. The idea is to develop self-ownership, collective working, shared learning and self-governance, participatory democracies and cultural democracies that are self-sustaining, or relatively self-sustaining. They work using the principles of the creative adhocracy, in which everything that happens within the cooperative structure takes the form of a project, and in which each project team is relatively autonomous and democratic. The model is flexible enough to be adapted for different contexts, cities, post-industrial towns, rural settings. Each incarnation is unique, driven by the needs of communities and its members. The concept is a marriage of heaven and hell. It operates on the principle of Robin Hood, taking from the rich and giving to the poor. For instance, it works with a big property developer to provide an alternative to the art centre as another shiny temporal for sale sign. Instead, it could become a long-term lease to a community benefit society, to the community, with some genuinely affordable housing leased to the cooperative to rent for the long-term benefit of the new creative community and the existing community. This can generate significant surplus for the cooperative, thereby ensuring self-sufficiency. It is a case of helping developers realise that art washing, gentrification and social cleansing is bad PR. Rather, developers showing that they really are committed to communities, old and new, can be very, very good PR indeed. And it also costs them very little. This marriage of heaven and hell is fraught with contradiction, or for Blake, contraries, but is, I believe, necessary. For me, this marriage is not about property, it is not about the arts. Rather, it is about trying to show that creativity can be humanistic and social, that capitalism must make concessions in return for profit. Because we are all consumers nowadays. We are all part of the neoliberal society, at least for now. Cooperatism is a form of capitalism. The Creative Commons is a form of capitalism, but not neoliberal capitalism. We need to find new ways of living and being on this planet and in our communities to value cultural experience and creativity, living and being creatively. We need to call for cultural democracy, participatory democracy, because we all have a right to the city, and it is up to us to demand that right. So am I of the devil's party? I would argue yes and no. The marriage of heaven and hell, of good and evil, is not what it first seems, and even if we turn traditional understandings upside down, as Blake did, we are still left sifting through the gaps between the poles and the moments, between the moments of dialectical tensions and situations some of us are only now beginning to discover or rediscover again.
Thank you. So, I guess that sort of hopefully sums up where I am, and I do believe that the idea we must realise the extent to which we live within a capitalist society, and I guess what I'm trying to think about are other forms of capitalism, and it's important to understand that even cooperativism and other forms of mutually living together will involve a form of capitalism, but it can be very different ones to the massively exploitative creative cities model, which tends to be used all around the world at the moment to say what we do is we have a creative quarter, and then just along there you have the business quarter, and we see some streets around here with graffiti, and if you look at, and then some streets around these buildings with very little, and if you look you'll see it, you can see quite clearly the more quirky forms of graffitied areas are the areas that haven't quite been cleaned up, and the areas which have been cleaned up, you'll notice clean walls and specific areas of specially commissioned art, which is different perhaps from the graph that's going on in other areas. And you can see, and it's very, very interesting to see this within this area here. Having said that, as Liam points out, gentrification does require the displacement of working class communities to be replaced by middle class communities. Arguably that hasn't happened yet in terms of accommodation, however I would argue it has in terms of economic models. In other words, this was once a place where working class people came to work in industries, and now it is a place where the creative class come to work in the creative industries, and that is a massive shift. That both drives and fuels the economy. The government says the creative industries are the biggest growth area in the UK. We lead the world. We lead the world in that area. And so, but at what cost? At what cost? Who benefits from this? And who doesn't? Who doesn't benefit? So I guess that's where I'd like to leave it. And hopefully, I'd like to ask anyone to ask questions, talk to us, to yourselves. And let's have an open discussion for the rest of the time we've got. First, please. Can I just say, we just keep questions short, responses short, and to get as many as possible.
Yeah. Can you talk more about how you make decisions about regeneration and how you incorporate participatory democracy into that?
How I make decisions?
How the group makes decisions?
Or how you use participatory democracy in that way? Participatory democracy requires, I guess, you have to go back to think about things from a grassroots perspective, and you have to start by talking and ask what my practice does is it goes in, it asks people what people want, and it builds something from there. And as in the examples in Mexico and things, and even here, what I try and do is set up an art project which really isn't an art project, right? It's something that's going to benefit the community by giving them something that they want, using arts money, that they hopefully can help them become sustainable is the idea, and help them in their community, I guess. and they decide and they become involved. And hopefully it's about, so it's much about building a group of people's understanding of how to participate and be democratic and organise, as it is about what the art and the creativity actually is at the end of it. So the product for me isn't a mural, it isn't a sculpture. It often has a small artistic element to it, but basically it's the system of helping people organise, come together and produce something for a much longer term that they can actually can build on outside of the arts. There, please, and then two.
You said before that normally gentrification requires the displacement of working class communities with middle class communities, and obviously that's not applicable to the Baltic Triangle because of the nature of the area. Obviously you're from the northeast, I don't know if you're based there, but
yeah.
Is there a similar kind of thing in Newcastle and in that area, or are there cities in the UK where similar things are happening, like the Baltic Triangle, where working class communities aren't being displaced?
Where
they're not being displaced, but gentrification is still, in a sense, possible.
Well, I mean, in Newcastle, there's the Quayside, there's the Ouseburn. Newcastle's one that an architectural city for a creative city generation. And then again, it hasn't displaced people, not really. But just to give you an example, I mean. The millions and millions of pounds spent in Newcastle's Quayside with the Baltic Centre for Contemporary Art, which is one of the most well-funded visual arts organisations in the country, and the Sage Gateshead, which is one of the most well-funded music venues in the country, classical music venues in the country. They're now just about to spend their £250 million on another massive venue between the two, right? Has it displaced anyone? Well, it displaced along the industry's declined and people had already lost their jobs, so no, not directly. But if you look at the index for multiple deprivation for that area, the area immediately surrounding the Baltic Keys, it is one of the most deprived areas still in the UK. What that shows is the millions and millions of pounds, who goes to the Baltic? And I've worked with these communities, and you know what? They don't go. It's not for them. The Sage is not for them. Even though it's funded, you pay at least £50 to go and see a band, if not more, for the opera. Right? And this is, right? It's not, people on benefits, they can't go. They can't afford it. So has it helped education? It hasn't helped at all. And so what you see is this investment brings in people from outside to come and enjoy this sanitised part of an area, whereas all around it, people are ignored and they're not being engaged by the arts communities. And for me, just think about how much, do we need these buildings or not, is one question. And imagine if we didn't build the 200 million new venue and instead spent that on creative interventions, new forms of collectivism, ways that could generate money for communities to decide how to spend themselves on what they want, not what we see or the people up the top want, that they want. Imagine how much you could do with £200 million, but they're not allowed to have it because no one trusts them, because they are just working class people. And what would they know? What would they know? And that is, for me, the crux of this argument.
There's a good example in Liverpool, because culture isn't just about art. Culture is also sport. And the culture of Liverpool is football. And Liverpool Football Club had a planning application denied because on non-planning grounds, I might add, because the community stood up en masse at the town hall and said, you know, actually, the football club treats us like shit. Like when there's a match day, people come and they wear my hall in my doorway, and you know I can't get to my house and all that sort of stuff. And what we really like is that there are 2 months of the year that we get a respite. And what your planning application is saying is that we want to do American football and we want to hold concerts. And the frustration really comes from when you read between the lines. That community doesn't feel like they have shared in the value. Football, Liverpool Football Club in particular, is an unbelievably wealthy business, and it's right in the heart of the most deprived neighbourhood in the United Kingdom. And there is something obscene about that. And when you saw the comments that happened on Twitter, you know, down the line from not just Liverpool's application, but the application happened here in the Baltic and some of the other stories about the store development sites, you see the distrust that people have, and like, and sometimes it gets waved away as conspiracy theories, but you see the distrust in the people that they won't share this value because that's a lived experience. And as you say, there's no mechanism by which the state, operating above their glass ceiling, is able to trust the masses with that kind of money.
There literally are estates in that I've been to in Southampton and in London where if people find out that you're an artist, and this is sort of the level, I guess, of the distrust that's been formed, often not necessarily correctly, but people have actually been chased off estates because the fear, because people now know, world-class people, if you're coming, you're going to either exploit us or we're going to lose our homes. It's seen as almost warning, gentrification area, artists coming, we're going to, further down the line, we're going to be kicked out and scattered across the country.
Can I add as well, this situation is by design. Mm-hmm. This is a situation that's been created in particular by the ideology of the right. And as a perfect example, the Whitehall expects Liverpool City Council to generate all or most of its revenue from business rates and council tax. Therefore, the city has to be obsessed with the idea of raising house price value so that the council tax band increases. We build more, a combination of a particular council tax band, and also we have developer-led regen. So we need more buildings, we need more business rates. And these two things, that's by design, that's a choice, that's an ideological choice by the right.
Yeah, I would agree.
I just wanted to ask for Baltic Creative what your commitment is to spaces of no value, for example, future-proofing, so agricultural spaces where you can grow food, access to water, spaces where people don't have to come and buy something, bottled water, coffee, because that is actually a gentrification in itself.
I just wondered how, if there are ideas on how to fight the kind of co-option of a lot of these sort of grassroots efforts by property developers and big businesses. Because I'm from London, and you know, I worked on an industrial set in a really poor area, and the private landlords started giving some of their units to artists for free in order to build a culture there and put up the business rates in the area. Like, that was a deliberate tactic of theirs. And also, you know, for example, a lot of these kinds of like grassroots artistic sort of efforts, you know, putting on a little gallery in your shed or these sorts of things, there are social media pages and websites who track these and write about them in order to generate engagement and feed that information back to large companies who will put on fake, spontaneous, artistic happenings.
Yeah.
In order to make money, they get information about what people like and what they like about these sorts of things, and then they put on fake ones. And like, how do we fight that?
Yeah,
the fact that they will take every creative idea we have and package it to make profit.
Okay, that's a really good point. I think there and then yourself, if that's all right, then we'll take some more questions after that.
Yeah, Lee, you're talking about the increase in, you know, residentialisation of Liverpool and the overseas property market is a real concern of mine amongst many city centres at the moment, and Liverpool as a council is in a very difficult position because it has to say yes to these horrible, homogenous, you know, high-rise developments, and I can't see it as a sustainable use cluster at all. So in terms of this area, how do you ensure there's a diversity of use clusters and it's not just all residential and bar culture? How to ensure there's lower business rates for startups, circular economy, sustainable businesses? How can we do that with the city council to ensure, you know, to ensure true sustainability of the area?
And one more.
I was interested in your film, Stephen, with the references to psychoanalysis, because
you're
trained to be a psychoanalyst.
Okay.
I'm also an architect. come to questions from both directions. What I'm going through psychoanalysis is that I come to this room, I come into any room embodied with the fact that I am the problem. And if I already am the problem, how do I then speak to what I'm trying to do? How do I speak to my actual genuine interest in wanting to be part of my community when I'm actually part of the problem because of all the other things that I embody? So I'm part of running a community charity in Lucian, and we run it on a model whereby university educated, middle class people like me don't make any decisions and don't put up any agendas. We only, because all our agendas, all are self-serving at some level, even our genuine ones. So we insist that we put out a call for people in the community who want to start a project and run a project to come to us with their ideas, and only the people who come up and bubble up from the community get to run the project and get to have a say on how the project runs. And what we then do is that we offer our resource to support them. But we don't start with any kind of plan.
Yeah, I think that's a useful example. We should try and get a hold of that example. Quickly, I'll respond, and then Liam to the Liverpool ones. So to begin with, I'll start with you. We must acknowledge we are a problem, and we can help others make their own decision about how they want to solve that problem. I think that's at the core. And I make it quite clear that I am of the devil's party, that I am complicit in this, whether it's through university or through all the things that we do. We have to bear that in mind, and I think it becomes about ethical practice. When is it ethical to become involved, and what does that involvement look like, and when is it unethical? And I think that comes on to your point, which what you're talking about in London, and I mean it happens all over the place now, is deeply unethical. But then that's because it's neoliberal, and neoliberalism is at heart deeply unethical. And the ideas around where you see these false things being set up is art washing, one form of art washing. There's, for example, a company, London Newcastle, who are a massive property developer, and they actually have their own gallery in Whitechapel as well. And they commission on all of the hoardings, on all of the estates that they do. When they knock down council estates, they commission artists to do it. And the worst example of all I saw was in the Haygate estate, before it was knocked down, Southwark Council and an arts organisation worked with a group of kids off the estate to draw pictures of the bulldozers and about what their life would look like, right, in the future, once they'd been displaced, and they actually printed them up on massive things and spent thousands of pounds around an estate when the kids had actually, which they were going to be displaced from in a few months' time.
I like what you said before about no matter what model we choose, we are within the context of our capital model. And I think it's really important to accept that. Although that's not the preferred model that I would want to live in, it is the one that we do live in. And if we want to affect change over a long period of time, which in economic terms is important, then we have to accept that being around the table is very, very important for us to affect that change. And sometimes that might actually, Jeremy Corbyn embodies that, in my opinion. As a Liberal Party, he's often been around the table with people who the media would call unscrupulous, and you have to be there with those people to have conversations. And so he's doing that in order to find peace. for us, it's about finding a new world order for, yeah. for some of these problems. So in response to some of the stuff that was asked, I'll go backwards. So being around the table means that you can tell the developers what you think is needed. Obviously, that has to be backed up by evidence, and then subsequently backed up by a business case. The challenge in that three-step phase is that the business case would need to add up. And so for example, the Great George Street development, which is the new Chinatown one that collapsed, that we all know was never planned to be built. But actually, their plans now include 2 and 3 bed apartments because the message has been very clear that single bed units are not wanted or needed. But that's not just from us, that's also, the economics are finally there saying that. There's 3,000 or more empty homes in Liverpool in ones and twos, and they're more expensive to bring back into use, but that's such a more sustainable and improved way of working with communities. We have to win that argument as well. And I think that the two ways that we can do that is we can ask slash demand, particularly of the combined authority in Liverpool City Region, that they go to Whitehall and demand the devolution of planning. Because London has planning devolution and it's not perfect, but it's damn sight better than zero, which is the influence that, that our politicians have over planning, which is absurd. And then running a genuine campaign of, backed up perhaps by a manifesto or a set of principles or ideas that's developed from a participatory, view of what we want and the things that we're asking for. Because we don't do a very good job at saying what it is that we actually want and need, and we definitely didn't do a very good job of backing it up with evidence. So to the point about what our organisations like Baltic Creative do for non-capital value things. I don't have an answer to that question, and I think that's partly because this model that we've developed here and the other models in the area are pretty new, and now that we've realised that the success it does weigh up in capital terms, actually the sky's the limit, and there will probably be people who are thinking about those things. One of the school that's here does house an urban farming project, which is a really great initiative to solving sort of food poverty and the challenges that we have with farming in general, but within an urban context. Some of the services that have been created here will go into fund projects that perhaps might not have an economic return. And the last point, was it your point? So you said something about the developers are giving away yours, right? What does that mean? What does it mean when somebody says...
They're literally saying live or like use this unit for
it's
a
not,
year.
Yeah, for a year.
For free.
So you're talking about meanwhile use. Not so meanwhile is like here are the terms in which you can use it, probably free, probably we pay for it, but after a year sort of, or after 5 years. Meanwhile use is prolific in the arts community because our buying power is low.
Yeah, I don't criticise the artists who take the property, but it's just how do you deal with the fact that this is just a tactic to get the business rent
out
of the area.
Well, partly actually, the artists are to not apportioning blame, but as an individual, you would never criticise someone for making a decision like that.
No.
Collectively, they are kinds of decisions that we should avoid taking, and we should demand more. But this is because when we act as an individual from an individual point of view, and where's the strength in union for artists? And where's our sort of collective ambition and aim about how we deal with developers and how we deal with these situations? Nobody briefs us. Nobody has these discussions are few and far between. So actually, at the core, that problem is caused by the individual taking the unit. But the issue is that we don't demand more for the value that we create, because we will create value. But it's about, if that unit was owned by the artist, and they said, you know, here, you can have that, then that value might be there forever.
Okay, we haven't got too long, so let's ask questions, and we'll try. You need really point them at us, I guess. So they first, and then you, and then was there anybody else who asked any questions? Yourself, any of us? Right. Okay. Four. Okay.
What I was just thinking about that if you do have a unit, then the people who take those units have, you know, this incredible amount that you could do with that. You could use it as a medical base to actually fight back and go into, you know, get people, pull people in, give free workshops, do all kinds of stuff with that space. That would then actually turn it around a bit, possibly.
They're still going to put the business rates up in there.
You're
still going to get trendy bakeries coming in.
Yeah.
The fact is that you can't anyway, because they won't let you do that, because that's not the terms of the agreement. So the developers won't allow you to do that at all. You have to do it, they won't allow it, they'll kick you out straight away. So that's not the problem.
Yeah. Just want to ask a question, and based on what you guys have just said, so I'm from North Shields Ridges, supply the most good, but actually live in South Birmingham, where I'm part of the local arts forum, so it's artists who live in the area, and we try and do stuff by form with the people where we live. So those of us who are doing this work will know that it's mentally and emotionally exhausting. So my question is, do you guys, or does anyone know of any kind of networking system so we can nationally kind of share ideas, share the heartbreak, support each other? Because I go to a lot of these things, and it's like a sugar rush, it's great.
Okay.
But it would be good to connect.
Right, we can answer that one, and maybe Nick will answer that.
Thank you.
Just to bring him in. But we'll take the next couple of questions. So I think this lady and then this gentleman here.
I just wanted to go back to the point that I think we really need to be honest with ourselves in this room today, that we're talking about privilege here. And if you've got all these opportunities but you haven't considered any of these factors, there's no accessibility to the other people in the community, really. So how honest are you going to be with yourself about that? Because none of these people are going to come if they can't afford to be in these spaces, and there's no spaces to be if you can't be for free. I've just been living in Egypt. It's a neoliberal property development project there where people are being moved on in malls if they're sitting down on a seat because they haven't purchased anything.
Yes.
This is where we're at now. This is what's happening.
Okay.
So we need to protect these areas.
Yeah, good point.
I just want to agree with the guy over here. I was going to say something very similar to what you're going to say, actually. And I think the whole question of arming ourselves with legal knowledge, okay, about property issues, because I think a lot of us are probably a little naive about this. We need to arm ourselves. And of course, if there is a network of experience across the country, then that expertise can be properly shared, and we can get savvy about how to actually approach property developers, owners, and know, in a sense, that what they're telling us isn't necessarily the case. We can actually get in there, find the cracks in the neoliberal system, because they are there, and then open those cracks.
Yes, there's a knowledge sharing thing there, and definitely. I think, Nick, can I ask you just to quickly respond, and then can you answer that sort of joint point, and then we'll close on that point, because I think that'd be a good place to finish, if that's okay. I would just briefly say, in response to all of your questions, I think we must understand that this is planned. This is part of planned development. Right, it's planned development, and ultimately the only people who make these plans is either your local councils or the state. Right, we often demonise artists, and yes, we are complicit. We often blame developers, but that's property developers are developing property. But they have to be given permission to do it, and those permissions are not given on a whim. They're planned 5, 10, 20, 50 years in advance. If you look and go into local councils and cities, you see areas, council estates, not on there anymore, right? This is way before CGIs are drawn up with white people sitting sipping lattes and stuff, right? This goes way in advance. And these guys, so we need to really become political. We need to challenge on a local and national level about properties, and just look at Labour. Labour Party, in my opinion, are an absolute disgrace on a local level and nationally. Corbyn may talk about being anti-gentrification, but to be honest, he's doing very, very little about it. In the meantime, Labour's councils are socially and ethnically cleansing vast swathes of this country, not just in London, but in the north as well. And it's an absolute disgrace. And until we stand together and make our party, the Labour Party, actually work for the people, right, and talk about proper council houses, not affordable houses, we will be screwed, right? And it's a massive vote winner, and it will win a general election, I can guarantee you of it.
Jeremy did say he's
going to
build a
council house.
They said yesterday.
He said, but when you look at the detail, it is very, very thin on the ground. It's very thin on the ground, indeed. And he's not challenging as well. Somebody needs to challenge the local councils, and I know that they're independent to a degree in decision making. But you know what? They need to fall in line with what Labour, because they are new. The National Party needs to understand that the actions of local councils, right, are basically losing votes, right, to on a national level, right? It needs to be dealt with.
Is the system not sustainable though? Because I've heard in London that because of Brexit, the multi-million-pound property market is drying up now. So all these developers, they planned to build all these properties like 5-10 years ago, and now they're halfway completed. And before Brexit, they were being sold completely like off plan. And now people are having to wait on years at a time.
Is this going off topic?
Patrick?
Yeah, thank you. I think it's important that we are accurate in the way we approach the debate. One of the things that I do in my professional life is I'm an elected member of Liverpool City Council. I also run a small publishing business in the Baltic Triangle here. Now in my capacity as a city councillor, I chair the city's enterprise and employment committee, and one of the things that I'm interested in is making sure that regeneration goes hand in hand with the jobs which people need in this city. And that brings me back to the language that we use, because I've just been accused of being involved in the social and ethnic cleansing of people in Liverpool. I'd like to push back on that just this time. Because Labour councils, we're under huge stresses financially, but we're under huge stresses in the way that not just from a central government that doesn't care about what we want to do and the way we want to improve the lives of the people in the area, but from the grassroots as well. When we 2 miles away from here, there's an estate called the Welsh Streets, which is known locally, which was in Rack and Ruin for 15, 20 years. City Council had said that we want to demolish it and replace it with social housing. And there was a huge pushback locally saying, no, these are lovely houses, we want to maintain them, we want to keep them, bring them back into use, and we want the communities that had previously lived there being brought back to live in those streets again. So we did, we changed our minds, we changed our policy, we didn't demolish those houses, we didn't demolish those streets, they look absolutely beautiful. The windows are back to how they were, the brickwork is back, it's painted lovely, the streets are fantastic. Problem is, it cost an arm and a leg to do that, and now the rents which are being charged to live in those houses are out of the reach of the people who we wanted to provide houses for. And they're always going to find that you've got difficult decisions to make. Do you want the original housing there? Well, great, but we can't afford to do that and have the people who have lived in those areas stay in that area. All at the same time, if we want to demolish it, replace it with brand new housing and rehouse the local community and the people back to the areas they were in.
Okay. Yeah, no worries. We're just about to run out of time. I would very quickly like to say I did not accuse you, to be clear, of Liverpool. I did not accuse Liverpool, I said some areas, many Labour councils, not all Labour councils, just to be clear, and I did not mention Liverpool. And secondly, you're right, I know about the Welsh streets, I know about those examples. And you know what? I think that you need to think a bit bigger, because surely we need to realise that, yeah, it might cost an arm and a leg, but what we need to do is invest properly, right? You're talking about the system at the minute, right? The system of years and years and years of austerity imposed upon you as a city council, right? What we shouldn't you be saying? This is not good enough, right? We need proper investment. And so what you're trying to do is rush argue, I would suggest, within the terms that have been imposed upon you, which you yourself have admitted are not the ideal terms. We need to start to think about what it might look like if we look at taxing properly, taking and really investing in communities so that all the things that you want can be done en masse, right, properly.
Can I just very quick,
we're out of time, unfortunately. I just wanted to say, I'm really sorry, this is just scratching the surface, obviously. We need to talk more about this, yeah, but the whole point, as I said at the beginning, of the Movement for Cultural Democracy, which is sponsoring this session and three more here, is to provide a platform for these sort of conversations. It came out of TWT last year, some sessions we ran at TWT last year about the new politics, culture, how we think about neoliberalism, patriarchy, racism, class as cultural issues, as well as thinking about the cultural industry and funding and all these things, and how to think those together. So that's what we'll be doing a bit more of here. The session at 1 o'clock in the shed here is about precarity. And so there were two really good speakers. One is Clara Palliard, and she's the president of the PCS Union Culture Group. So she'll be talking about conditions in the cultural industry workforce and how you think about those. And at the same time, and the second speaker will be talking about, he's got some amazing research that he's done that he's going to release here for the first time around, about culture industry funding and inequalities in culture industry funding. So how the lottery basically sucks up money from the poor and gives it to elite arts and much more. So if you want to discuss that, come along at 1 o'clock. Tomorrow, we've got an amazing... Do you want to say something about tomorrow, Rhiannon's session?
Yeah, Rhiannon White's from a theatre company, grassroots theatre company called Commonwealth Theatre, and based in Cardiff and Bradford. And she's been working. We commissioned her to work on around what is that? What are cultural conditions like for working class women in a community where there's no investment at all in culture?